Let's go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. That's not our text. We will be back in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. But in 2 Thessalonians 3, the Apostle Paul makes some statements that I think will give us the right perspective on the chapter we begin looking at this morning. And so we'll read those here in just a moment. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. I want to begin reading a couple of statements here that express the kinds of struggles that as human beings, as fallen human beings, we all face. Even as we're trying to do good things, serving Christ, and striving to be of help to other people in ministry and local church, nevertheless, these are the struggles often in our hearts. And I think it may surprise you from whom these statements come. I want to read you a few statements from the 1800s, September 19, 1840. I feel a great deal of envy at hearing of the success of others. And he means other preachers. A few years later, October 29, 1854. It is pride that often makes me inattentive to the sermons and prayers of some people whom I think not very spiritual. And this man acknowledged the years that God was really helping him have victory over that pride, but actually a long time later, close to his death, I think he was in his 70s at this point, March 15, 1884, had been more and more led to be unwilling to speak of work done by myself or my congregation. It is so difficult to escape from self-importance. And those words come from the pen of the great Scottish Presbyterian pastor Andrew Bonar. We're going to jump ahead about 100 years to another well-known figure. My soul is exceedingly filled with contempt this Lord's Day morning. Passions plagued me all day yesterday and lashed me this morning again. Oh, wretched man, when shall I be rid of you? How long must flesh quench spirit, drown devotion and silence prayer? My God, deliver me from myself. Such awful upsurges of pride attend my conversation these days, and the abomination of a self-filled heart wells uncalled to my lips. And that comes from the diary of missionary Jim Elliot. And to jump ahead about 25 years later to the man, a preacher who is still alive today, retired from the pastorate, prominent evangelical minister, reflecting on his experience when he began the ministry and was involved in planning a church, and things seemed to be going south, and he was very frustrated. He said, years earlier when I began the ministry, my motivation was simply to serve Christ. That was all. But imperceptibly, my high Christian idealism had shifted from serving to receiving, from giving to getting. I realized that what I really wanted was a growing church and, quote, success more than the smile of God. And that comes from the ministry of R. Kent Hughes. Do you ever struggle with those sorts of thoughts? Are you ever tempted to discouragement because as you attempt to minister to other people, you find that things perhaps aren't going very well. You're not getting the recognition that you think you deserve. Your heart is filled with pride over things that you did that did go well. Do we ever struggle with motivations in the ministry? Well, if the answer to that question is yes, then 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 is for us. And hopefully you remember enough about this book to know something of where this chapter fits into the flow of thought at this point. The Apostle Paul had had a revolutionary ministry in the city of Thessalonica. Many people had been converted, a solid church established, but it had been a very brief ministry, probably limited to the 3 weeks that we have recorded in the book of Acts chapter 17. And when the persecution geared up against him, Paul is compelled to move on to the city of Berea, where things go a little bit better for him circumstantially. What we want to do is try to put ourselves in the shoes of those new converts. And I think we can appreciate how natural it would be to start asking questions about what in the world is going on when I have given my life to this Christ that this stranger was preaching, and I made such a radical commitment to him, and then the guy disappears. He just falls off the picture entirely. What am I to think of the Apostle Paul? And particularly if people outside of the church, maybe family members that I had to make a break with, maybe people out in the work world who are mocking me, who are trying to get me back to my heathen way of life, are beginning to cast doubt in my mind about this guy who showed up and to whom I listened and who had such a dramatic impact in my life. Where is he now? Why did he run off so quickly? Those are the kinds of issues that these people in Thessalonica would have been struggling with, and that is the background for essentially the self-defense of Paul as he talks to them regarding his ministry. And in society, the society of that time, those kinds of concerns would have been even more pronounced because, in fact, back in that day, they didn't have cable TV. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have so-called Christian radio. But there were plenty of voices out there proclaiming philosophical and religious messages. But it wasn't through technology. It was by people showing up as traveling philosophers, traveling preachers, sort of putting their wares out and gaining a following for themselves. The ancient world was glutted with those sort of roving, hawking preachers and philosophers. People who were out there using eloquent speeches to get others' attention, to get a following for themselves, to get rich, as the case may be. And so people at large had to learn how to distinguish between those you could really trust, sincere philosophers, sincere preachers, how to distinguish between them and frauds. And whole treatises were written about how to test these roving speakers. A cynic philosopher from the first century by the name of Dio Chrysostom says this: to find a man who in plain terms and without guile speaks his mind with frankness, and neither for sake of reputation nor for gain makes false pretensions, but out of goodwill and concern for his fellow man stands ready, if need be, to submit to ridicule and to the disorder and the uproar of the mob. To find such a man as that is not easy, but rather the good fortune of a very lucky city, so great is the dearth of noble, independent souls, and such abundance of toadies, he calls them. Flatterers is the meaning. Mountebanks means a charlatan, a trickster, and sophists. That sounds very much like the wording in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Maybe Paul had some experience with the writings of this man. He's having to defend himself against those sort of charges and questions. What kind of man is he? Paul is having to defend his ministry, but as we think about that background, I want us to realize this is not just a historical curiosity for us reading the Bible. It's not just there to solve that original problem. But in fact, everything in Scripture is there for our instruction and by way of example and teaching for us. It is not limited either just to those who are spiritual leaders in the church, the preacher, pastor types. And that's why I've had you turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. A little bit later, Paul is writing to these same people in this letter. And if you look with me at chapter 3, verses 7 to 9, this is what he says in talking about the same ministry that he's discussing in our passage. 2 Thessalonians 3:7. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example Because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it, but with labor and hardship we kept working night and day so that we would not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have the right to this, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you so that you would follow our example. You see, Paul is talking about the same sorts of issues that come up in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, how he went about ministering, particularly the fact that he was what we would call today a tent maker in a very literal sense. That's where that word comes from, his example. And he says, I did this for the sake of the ministry, and my work ethic and my approach to the ministry, I was doing it by way of example. And so when we come to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, let's have that mindset. That when Paul talks about his motives and his methods as an apostle preaching the gospel to these people, this is recorded as an example for how anybody's ministry is to proceed, no matter what God has called you to do as a member of his body, the church. Now, actually, the apostle Paul's defense doesn't begin in chapter 2. He's been suggesting this all along from the very beginning. And if you look at chapter 1, we have studied that carefully. But notice how a lot of this is just reflecting on what happened when he showed up to preach at Thessalonica. You remember this verse, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 5. He brings it up as a proof of their election. He says, we know you're elect because our gospel did not come to you in word only. And he says a few other things about the nature of his ministry with them. As soon as he's done talking about himself, he goes on for the rest of the chapter to talk about how the people of Thessalonica responded. Remember that? There were two sides. How do you know if somebody's elect? Well, what was going on in the preaching of the gospel, and did God send a qualified messenger to give them the truth? And then secondly, how did they respond to that? There's the preacher and then there's the people responding to the message. In chapter 1, verse 9, you see those two sides again. For they themselves report about us what kind of a reception we had with you. So there's the preachers. And then, on the other hand, and how you turn to God from idols, etc., etc. So here again, he is looking at both sides, and in chapter 2, we're going to see those same sides come up, but there's going to be a lot more development. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain. And I pointed out last time that the word coming is the same word reception in chapter 1, verse 9. He's taking up the preacher side once again, and he goes on and on about that until the end of verse 12. And then in verse 13, he goes back to the people, and he says, for this reason, we also constantly thank God that when you received the word from us, you didn't accept it as the word of men, but for what it really is, the word of God. And he develops now their response once again. And there's this cycle of ideas that he goes back and forth between to validate what is going on as something truly from God. There's some things that have to be true about the preacher. There's some things that have to be true about the people in order to confirm that ministry. And we're going to begin this morning looking at the minister's side, but again, not limited to him as an example of any kind of ministry. Let's take a closer look at this passage as we get started here. And at the beginning of the section, notice how many times there is a negative. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. Our coming to you was not in vain. Verse 3. Our exhortation does not come from error. Verse 5, for we never came with flattering speech, nor with a pretext for greed. You see how Paul is trying to clear some things off the table. And he says, it was not this, it was not that, it was not the other. That is not what our ministry was like. And then he takes a positive turn in verse 7. But we proved to be gentle, having so fond an affection for you. You recall, verse 9, our labor and hardship. Devoutly, uprightly, we behaved among you. We were exhorting you like a father and so forth. Now he's gone to the positive side. So he said, our ministry was not like this, but now positively let me describe it for you. Both of those aspects work hand in hand. Our focus today is going to be on the negative side that he is discounting, and the theme of this passage, a self-oriented ministry denied. He is denying that his ministry was characterized by these selfish motives. And furthermore, this passage divides up very nicely into three blocks of two verses each. We're going to look at those, but just to give you an idea of how we're going to approach this. As Paul begins each of these little sections, first of all, he sets forth his denial. We did not do this. This was not our approach. And then he's going to back that up. He's going to confirm it by saying, now, let me defend that statement. Let me give you the reason I am claiming that. Let me give you the basis of that denial. And in all of that together, what we're seeing this morning are characteristics that demonstrate that our ministry is not self-oriented. How would you know that, in fact, as you minister to the people of God, whatever your role might be, that it is not a self-oriented ministry? Well, here are three characteristics. First of all, in the first couple of verses, we see a willingness to minister in spite of hardship. A willingness to minister in spite of hardship. Notice the denial in verse 1. You yourselves know, brethren, and throughout this section he is continually helping them recall. You know this. Just think back on what happened. It's in there in your consciousness. You have this confirmed from your own experience. You know that our coming to you was not in vain. That's what he's denying, that it was not in vain. Now, what does that mean? You might be tempted to say, well, it means that there were results, that people got saved, that it wasn't fruitless in that sense, that he didn't walk away without converts. And that is certainly true. But that's not really a point under discussion. That's not what's being debated here. In fact, the whole reason people would be questioning his ministry is precisely because there had been results, and they are challenging what it was all those converts were committing themselves to. Don't take the word vain there to mean that a lot of people got saved. You know that you could have a selfless, Christ-like ministry and not see the kind of results the Apostle Paul did. That's not the issue. That is not the ultimate proof as to whether you are serving God sincerely, whether or not people respond. The word vain here literally means hollow or empty. And I would say that that conveys the idea of something without substance, something just non-substantial, that doesn't have any real weight or value to it. We might say our ministry was not a waste of time. Our ministry was not void of value. Our ministry was not purposeless. There was something real and meaty to this. That's what he's denying. And now how does he back up that statement? What is the basis of this denial in verse 2? To those people who were perhaps challenging him as a kind of fly-by-night, flash-in-the-pan philosopher, Paul says, now just think about this. What were the circumstances in which we arrived in Thessalonica? He says in verse 2, it was not a hollow, unsubstantial ministry, but after we had already suffered and been mistreated in Philippi, as you know, we had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel of God amid much opposition. What's the point? Do you really think that if we just were out to make money, and in Thessalonica the day before, we had been ridiculed, humiliated, flogged, imprisoned, and it was only because of an earthquake that we got out of jail? Shamed even as Roman citizens, do you really think if we were out looking for our own comfort and had nothing of value to say other than to get people to listen to us and give us money and treat us nicely. Do you really think we would keep ministering under those conditions, knowing that that's what would happen to us as well in Thessalonica? You see my point. It is the willingness to minister in spite of hardship that characterizes a selfless sort of ministry. And Paul says, in spite of that persecution, we came and we were not soft-spoken. We weren't tentative, like saying, why don't y'all consider this? You know, I've got one option among many. I happen to like Jesus. Why don't you think about it? Maybe we can sit down and dialogue. No, he says, I spoke with boldness. There was no sense of restraint, like I'm having to tone down the message because I'm afraid how people are going to treat me if they don't agree. I am giving them with clarity and with fullness the gospel message. I'm not fudging it at all. I'm not toning down just how exclusive and dogmatic Jesus really is. Do you think that would be the spirit of somebody who's just out to get a following, that he would get up and be so dogmatic and proclaim so boldly an unpopular message? And he says, I did so amid much opposition. You know, the word opposition there is the one from which we get our term agony. The Apostle Paul, not just in Thessalonica, but as a description of his entire ministry. How would you like this to be the description of what you went about doing from day to day? I live an agonizing life. That was the Apostle Paul. And what he's saying is, do you think I'd be willing? There are a lot better, easier ways to make myself rich and famous than carrying out this sort of agonizing ministry, being chased all over the Roman Empire just because I'm talking about Jesus. Whether you look at it physically or emotionally or spiritually, agony really was the character of this man's ministry. Now, how does that relate to us? We do not share those circumstances with the Apostle Paul. We don't know what the future holds. Maybe we ought to be firmed up as we go into the days ahead by Paul's example, but whatever the circumstances might happen to be. But you find it so easy to complain about whatever ministry the Lord has given to you. Why is this so hard? Why do I feel like every day and I get up and I try to serve the Lord, it's just like I'm walking an uphill battle. Nobody seems to care. Nobody is responding. There's just nothing simple about this. It's just one load of problems after another. Why are there so many obstacles in the way? Why are there so few results? Now, I'm not here to give you the answer to all those whys, but I do think I can give you one answer from the basis of Paul's statement here. I think one reason God gives us difficulties in ministry is for us to have the opportunity to prove the sincerity of our devotion, the right motives. Anybody can minister joyfully and be an example when the world is patting you on the back and people are flocking to listen to you and everybody loves you. But when people hate you and people reject you and you don't have enough money and you do not have people's support and encouragement, well, anybody can quit under those circumstances. It would take somebody who's doing that out of a sincere love for God and love for people to persevere under those circumstances. And this is the first mark of a ministry that denies a self-orientation. It is a willingness to minister in spite of hardship. Number two, the Apostle Paul here speaks of a sense of accountability to God. A sense of accountability to God. That would be the second characteristic. And what does he deny in verse 3? He says, our exhortation as we're standing up there appealing to people, encouraging them to receive Christ and so forth. that exhortation does not come from error, meaning we're not mistaken ourselves. It's not that somehow we were tricked by somebody else and we are in error, we are confused, we have been deceived. He denies that. He says our exhortation doesn't come either from impurity. And typically in the New Testament, that term is referring to sexual uncleanness. And actually, there are passages, if you look, for example, sometime at 2 Peter chapter 2, that connect closely false teaching with sexual immorality and licentiousness. Paul may have that in mind particularly. That certainly would be a motive for people going around, looking out for themselves, is to be gratified in that way. But I think we can include any other kind of impure motive, whether it's just ambition, whether it's greed, the list could go on. He says, number 4, in verse 4, here is something else he is denying. We're not out to please men. And that word please, referring not just to making somebody happy with you. There have been discovered a number of inscriptions in the Roman Empire where that term was used to describe people who were in some kind of a public servant role or were wealthy and were trying to help the community. And their names were inscribed on these memorials so that other people would recognize them, think well of them. For them to be pleased with you is for you to have done something well for them that they recognize you for. In other words, it has to do with gaining somebody's approval, somebody's commendation. And he says, that's not what my ministry is all about, getting people to like me and approve of me. You say, well, on what basis do you make that denial? Anybody can say that. On what basis do you make that denial? Verse 4, Paul says, well, really, I actually am an approval seeker. We, in dealing with people sometimes, we might be tempted to call them an approval junkie because it's all about getting people to like you. Well, the Apostle Paul was an approval seeker. And ultimately, everybody is looking to be affirmed and approved. The question is, by whom do you want to be approved? And listen to verse 4. Just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak not as pleasing men, but God who examines our hearts. Paul says, I want to gain God's approval. Now that may sound a little bit odd, given that Paul, in other places, is so insistent that it is not by our effort that we gain the approval of God. He is not talking here about that ultimate issue of our righteous standing before God, our acceptance. We understand that our approval in that sense was guaranteed by the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. But what we may not realize is that actually as a part of this gospel motivation, because, precisely because we have gained that approval by Christ, we want God to be pleased with our lives. We want our experience and our conduct to conform to that righteous standing that He has given us by His grace. Our drive and our passion, specifically in this area, is that when we are out there in the world representing God by our ministry, whatever that might be, we want Him to look down and be satisfied. We don't want Him to be ashamed of us. We don't want Him to reject us and our ministry in the sense that He looks at what we're doing and He says, I'm sorry, but that just is worthless. That doesn't amount to anything in my sight. We want God to be pleased with us. And that is not legalism. This is the Apostle Paul speaking here. He says, in one sense, I actually have already been approved by God. You see there in verse 4, just as we have been approved by God, probably referring to the fact that now for some 20 years almost, the Apostle Paul had developed a track record of ministering in this way. The word approved there has to do with a testing process, just as they would use in order to test whether a metal was pure. Just as if you were being hired for a job, they might give you a test to see if you're qualified for that particular position. That's what we're talking about here. It is an approval that comes as a result of having successfully passed a test. And Paul says, in my conscience, I am convinced that through my years of ministry, God has tested me and He has approved of what I'm doing. But on the other hand, it's not as though that's a one-time thing. This is an ongoing issue when he says, not as pleasing men, but God who examines our heart. And the word examines is from the same root as the word approved. There is this ongoing testing going on. God is continually evaluating the way that I minister to people, how I minister to people, what I'm giving them, what motivates me. God is the one who is regularly putting me to the test, not just about what I do, but what's going on in my heart. And it is before Him that I stand or fall, and gaining His approval is my motivation. Apostle Paul lived with a sense of the weightiness of God's own evaluation on his conscience. He couldn't rest on past accomplishments. Couldn't be satisfied with whatever he did during those other 2 decades. He says, no, this is a present, ongoing thing. God is evaluating. Now, how would you know whether our ministry is self-oriented? What sort of things do go through our minds and dominate our hearts? For example, when things in the ministry don't seem to be going well, do we find our heart continually going in this route? This is such a waste of time. Nobody cares. Why am I giving my life and my energy to this? What about when things are going well in the ministry? Is this our response? This is great! My life is amounting to something. I've really attained something here. Listen to what Paul says in another place. Therefore, we have as our ambition to be pleasing to God, because we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body. Specifically there again, talking about ministry efforts according to what he has done, whether good or worthless. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, meaning living under that sense of our direct accountability to God, what will he say? We are made manifest to God, and I hope also in your consciences. All that Paul is saying here is what Jesus was getting at when he gave that parable. And to the man who had been faithful as a steward, caring for God's possessions, the talents he had been entrusted with, he comes to the judgment day, and God says, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." This is the drive. There is an approval that we're seeking. And Paul says, let every man stand before the Lord in his own conscience as to what is driving you. But I want to testify, this is my ambition, to be examined and approved by Him. So there is that aspect. We've talked, number one, about a willingness to minister in spite of hardship. We've talked, number two, about a sense of accountability to God. And we come finally to verses 5 and 6. And here is another characteristic. There is a de-emphasis on position. A de-emphasis on position. The denial we find, beginning in verse 5, Paul says, "We never came with flattering speech," which was something else that was criticized in the lives of many of those philosophers, that they used these smooth words just to make people feel good and make it more likely for people to give something to them. He says as well, we didn't come with a pretext for greed. I like the way the King James puts it, without a cloak of covetousness. In other words, like we had this coat on that was hiding under there, that really what we were wanting was money from these people. We didn't mask that a desire to get rich. And then he says in verse 6, nor did we seek glory, meaning praise, honor, recognition, whether from people inside the church or outside the church. He says, I'm going to just deny that. I wasn't flattering you. I wasn't out for your money. I didn't want your praise. He says, all right, let me talk about that some more as he wraps up verse 6. And the basis of his denial takes a little bit of an ironic turn, because there was a sense, actually, in which the unique position that the Apostle Paul had actually deserved a respect, an honor. He was an apostle. And even though that term was used with reference to a lot of different people in the New Testament, he was an apostle in the strictest technical sense, one of very few people in all the world who were commissioned by God with the authority to work miracles, to give new doctrine as the foundation of the church, to be among the founders of the church age. And he says, I didn't clutch on to that, coming to you, saying, don't you know who I am? Don't you know what I deserve? Don't you realize the unique position, the blessing, the privilege that you have to have me standing up here talking to you? There's a sense in which he deserved honor for that unusual position. One of the ways that another translation puts his statement in verse 6, even though as apostles of Christ we might have asserted our authority, they say, we could have imposed our weight as apostles of Christ. You've heard the phrase, throw your weight around. That's what he's talking about here. Name dropping, putting my credentials out there, and expecting that because of the unusual position that I have, I deserve better than what you're giving me. Actually, Paul did not go around reminding people of who he was, except in this sense. Do you realize, in another place where he defended himself in 2 Corinthians, when he comes to defending his apostleship, here's what he says. In everything, commending ourselves as servants of God. In other words, here are my credentials. It's not, I'm one of the few. Look that I studied under Gamaliel. Look how many books of the Bible I've written. He says, here's how I commend myself. In much endurance, in afflictions, in hardships, in distresses, beatings, imprisonments, tumults, labors, sleeplessness, hunger. These are the credentials of an apostle. And he says, I don't go around throwing my weight around. This is the kind of life that I'm living for you. See how he is de-emphasizing his position. Now, what are our thoughts when in the ministry we are rejected or we are misunderstood? And these are things that we may not actually have the courage or we may be too ashamed to say, but have you ever found yourself thinking this way? Something like this. You obviously don't know who I am. Do you realize how much education I have? Do you realize how long I've been serving the Lord in this church? Do you understand how much I'm giving up so that I can help you? Do you understand how hard I work for you? And this is the treatment I get? In other words, throwing out your credentials, throwing out your efforts to try to elevate yourself in the eyes of other people and being frustrated when they just don't get it, how privileged they are to have you in their life. Paul says, I am de-emphasizing the position. And that's coming from a man who really deserved a lot of honor. That would be throwing your weight around. That would be flaunting your credentials and your achievements as if somehow inherently you arrived at those things. That would be a self-oriented ministry. But what are the characteristics that demonstrate our ministry is not self-oriented? What we've seen in these verses is a willingness to minister in spite of hardship. It is a sense of accountability to God and a de-emphasis on position. I want us to conclude this morning by looking at the statement that's printed in your bulletin. This is from a helpful little Bible study book on 1 Thessalonians, written by a man named David Jackman. And I think he captures well the thrust of Paul's ministry in this passage. He says, if our Christian service is motivated by wanting others to affirm us, to be pleased with us, and to praise us, that will be all we have to hold on to when the going gets tough. It's like Jesus said about people who pray to be recognized. Okay, they have their reward. But of course, they won't be serving Christ at all. What we're actually doing when we fall into that temptation is to go back to the old idol shrine that is really dedicated to ourselves. The only corrective is to realize that in the final analysis, human approval does not matter. If we fear men so that deep down we are really looking for their approval, then we shall not fear God. Proverbs says, the fear of man brings a snare. But if we fear God, then we shall not fear men. And we all know how Christian ministry is so easily captivated by men, whether within the local church or in denominational structures. We all come under that sort of pressure. To be liberated from the desire for approval by others sets us free to start pleasing God. And may the Lord help us in this church, in our ministry, to reject, to deny a self-oriented approach.